Okay, folks, we are about to start the fixed out audio problems, and I will present the problems. Our friend did give me a joke, though, which I'm going to use. Shanti of Austin, who is the Anarchist Panther, approved this joke, so if anybody doesn't like it, go to him. So how many Anarchists does it take to put together a poet, whether to make an audio and DVD player work? 13, one to put plug everything in, the other 12 to twinkle. That wasn't bad, right? That wasn't bad. Thank you guys for coming out. My name is Matt Paul Franklin. I'm a member of the Malcolm X Gratitude Movement, and I passed out some materials for everybody to read about our organization. And I'm also an attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights, which is a legal institution, actually, it's not too far from here, but does a lot of work on human rights and state constitutional rights. And the reason we're here today is to discuss what we call the San Francisco Eight, which are mainly former Black Panther Party members who were recently arrested and charged with a 35-year-old case of murder in terms of a police officer in San Francisco. And there are many of us in the Black Liberation Movement and other communities that fully support these brothers and feel like they're being targeted by the federal government, by public telco, and by local law enforcement agencies to really try to change the history of the civil rights, the Black Power Movement, Black Liberation Struggle, and to come out and to really disparage and really just try to use these brothers as targets. Many people will be scared to do activism work, scared to do organizing work, scared to get out in the street and to challenge government authority. So we think it's really important that we support these brothers and know all we can about them. This is going to be about the show. It gives a great overview of who they are and what the case is about. So I really don't want to discuss too much or say too much rather than repeat anything that we said in the film. And once again, I think the film does an excellent job of explaining everything. So without further ado, we're going to put the film on and afterwards I will answer any questions and give you a little update about where the case is at.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
When COINTELPRO was at its height, which is in the 60s and very, very early 70s, that one of the main focuses was on the Black Panther Party. And in fact, J. Edgar Hoover, who masterminded COINTELPRO, labeled the Black Panther Party as the number one threat to national security in the United States. So at that time, Hoover authorized all kinds of illegal activity against the Black Panther Party.
Fred Hampton was he was assassinated by COINTELPRO in Chicago, drugged, set up, murdered while he was asleep, actually unconscious in his bed.
COINTELPRO caused so much dissension in the community. The fallout from this is still being felt today. There were people who were natural associates who were made enemies by letters and phone calls, while the FBI agents and people who planned this laughed in the background.
They were law violators, and they all were law enforcement agents.
In 1973, 13 alleged members of the Black Panther Party were arrested in New Orleans. Various detectives from police departments and other parts of the country immediately flew to New Orleans to participate in the interrogation of some of the arrestees.
We were taken to New Orleans City Police Department. And we stripped the ball cover down to underwear. I was thrown in a cell, a holding cell.
I was put in the jail cell and questioned by different jurisdictions. The jurisdictions of San Francisco, New York, New Orleans, and Los Angeles, California.
Inside the holding cell, Ruben Scott, man, he was really afraid, he was trembling, he was scared. I could tell he had been beaten on it.
I was in New Orleans when my associates were arrested, John Bowman, Reuben Scott, and Harold Chair. And it was just by coincidence that I was arrested. I found out later that they had been tortured by the New Orleans police.
I was in there for maybe 5 minutes with the door open. Three police officers in New Orleans came in and gripped me up by my heels, took me to a chair. They handcuffed me to the chair, handcuffed my ankles, my feet to the bottom part of the chair. Without asking me any questions, they continued to commence beating me. They beat me, they punched me, they kicked me, they spit on me. They called me a lot of vile names. And then they told me that they were going to kill me if I didn't cooperate with them.
The New Orleans Police Department would come into the room where hot blanket would be taken from the bucket, dripping, hot and wet, placed over my head, held there for, I can't say, whether it was minutes or seconds, it felt like forever.
It came out of a plastic bag, put it over my head, and they started beating me with the bag over my head. About the time I was about to lose consciousness, about to pass out, they snatched the bag off. And while I'm trying to catch my breath, they would start beating me again. So I asked them, I said, what do you want? You know, they just continued on with it. They didn't ask me any more questions. They didn't ask any questions, really.
Two of the detectives who came from San Francisco were named Frank McCoy and Ed Ernolatz. They had been investigating a police homicide that had occurred in 1971.
Then they came out with this cattle prod. I knew what it was because being off of a farm when I was a kid, I used to have my family used to go to Louisiana every year to work with a family farm. And my uncle, they had a couple, we had some cows and they used cattle prods and we those cows up chutes and stuff like that. So I seen that and I knew what it was.
The cattle prod was placed on my genitals, placed in my asshole, placed under my feet, placed under my arms.
Down in my private parts, under my neck, behind my ears, down my back. I think I passed out one time and woke me back up, and they taken me to another room. Two detectives had me by one arm, by each arm, and a detective came out of nowhere and just cold cocked me. He knocked me straight out. I was unconscious.
Another instrument that was used during the questioning was a ledger log book. This ledger log book was used to fit the upside in my head at times when I was not giving the right answers that was scripted for me.
It took me to a holding cell. It threw water on me. I was soaking wet, it was cold. Pulled me out of there, maybe about 6 or 7 in the morning, and told me they had somebody I wanted to talk to, and I'd better cooperate, and if I didn't, I was going to get more of the same. So they put me in as two detectives from San Francisco. I later found out it was McCoy and Bergman. They started asking me questions. They told me they had a script, I'm sure I saw it recorded there too. And they were reading to me about what they said took place in San Francisco. I told them I had no knowledge of it.
When I did not answer the questions in the way that they wanted them to be answered, this is when the instruments that I named before would be used, primarily by the New Orleans Police Department. They were the main physical aggressors. The FBI, the San Francisco Police, and the Los Angeles Police, and the New York Police were the ones to do questioning after the physical abuse had taken place from the New Orleans Police Department.
Torture has an ugly connection with United States history, at least dating back to slavery. The lynching of slaves who ran away, the castration, the mutilation of slaves, was all used in this country and not sanctioned for hundreds of years. In the 60s and 70s, particularly against the Black Panther Party, beatings and interrogation, forms of torture were being used against members of the Black Panther Party primarily. And what happened in 1973 in New Orleans is one example.
All during the time this was taking place after the John Bowman. And another one where he was hollering, and you could hear the lips being passed. They took what they call a slap jacket. It's like a little short black jacket. So they started working the back of the neck, my shoulders. Then one of the guys, he worked my shins in between my knees, and he beat me like that every day. I don't know, it seemed like it was an hour, but it could have been 30 minutes, it could have been an hour, it could have been 2 hours, I don't know. It's back again with the plastic bag. This time they had a blanket. I don't know what they soaked it in, but it was really, really hot. And they just covered me with that blanket to put that plastic bag over my head. And I couldn't scream, I couldn't holler, I couldn't get my hands up to poke a hole in the bag, and I was handcuffed to the chair, my legs tied to the chair. And they kicked the chair over, and let me just suffocate. I was just about to pass out, they snatch it off, spit my face, and let me sit there for a little while. And that's a coin. Or like, they started asking questions to me. I had no knowledge of the things they were asking, so I couldn't ask them, you know. So they said, well, we'll turn off the recorder in one of their hands. He said, we'll tell you what happened. And then after we tell you, this is what we want you to say.
So, I did make statements. I did waive my right to an attorney, which means I waived my Miranda rights. I did all of this because of the physical aggression and the brutality that was being put upon my body.
One got behind me. And he took his hand and slapped him right there over my ear, and I couldn't hear nothing. My ears were just ringing so bad. I could feel fluid running down the side of my face. And they were talking to me, but I couldn't hear them. All I could hear was the ringing. Whenever they stood me up to make me walk, I couldn't walk. They had to just kind of just carry me back into another room. When they did it back in there, it started again.
Telling them that I needed to speak to an attorney, I actually invited them in.
And through the course of their interview, found out that they were investigating some unsolved crime in 1971. And during the course of the interview, which turned out started out very amiable, at the end, Mr. Erlatz was seething and told me that he intended to see us all behind bars, and he named a whole list of people, some I knew and some I didn't know.
I started piecing together what was going on by interviewing each of the men who had been visited by McCoy and Erlatz. And what became clear was from what McCoy and Erlatz had said to them was that they were investigating this 1971 police homicide that had occurred at the Ingleside Police Station in San Francisco. But they were also investigating alleged linkages between members of the Black Panther Party and members of the Weather Underground. And so most of these men, when they were approached, were asked if they, quote unquote, knew any white people. And they were told that the focus of McCoy and Erlatz's questioning was going to be about their knowledge of white people and not about their knowledge of any alleged crimes or any alleged personal involvement. As time went on, they asked for fingerprints from people, they asked for saliva samples from people, they threatened to use grand jury process in order to gather information from them. So then it became clear that there was more going on and that there may be a grand jury panel investigating the 1971 incident.
One night, out of the blue, Sheriff's Department knocks on my door. I think it's about six police altogether, six. Three deputy sheriffs, we got two FBI agents, two people from the state of California, but they came to ask, tell me that they were serving a subpoena for me to appear for the grand jury. This is their third night time. I said, well, you know what, I need to contact the lawyer before I acknowledge any of this stuff, because I don't understand what's going on. So they said, well, you got to appear to court at 8:30 in the morning.
In the last couple of years, I've been finally subpoenaed, fingerprinted, photographed, threatened, flown back and forth at government expense from Los Angeles to San Francisco to appear in front of the grand jury. When I appeared in front of the grand jury, I decided not to testify. When I refused to testify, I was held in contempt by Judge Dendero there in San Francisco County Court, and was jailed until October 31st when the grand jury expired.
I refused to testify. I still have my constitutional rights. 14th and 5th Amendment. And they told me that the judge ordered me to testify. He asked me to understand. I told him, yes, I understand. Took me back from the grand jury. I still recited my rights. So he held me contempt, took me to jail. I'm not going to sit there after all they've done to my friends, after all they've done to me over the years, interrupting my life, failing me, sending me to prison, making things, conditions and things hard for my children, my family now. So when you take me away from my family, my children suffer. And my community suffers because I'm a community activist. And this is the whole purpose, was to just disrupt me from my focus and from the things that I've invested in. That's serving the people and taking care of my children. So, no, I don't want to cooperate with these people under any circumstances, especially since they're criminals. These are the people. They should be investigated. They should be locked up for what they did in New Orleans to my friends. I myself was locked up for approximately a month and a half, put in a cell by myself, wouldn't let me have no counselor, no pencil pen, wouldn't let me make a phone call, wouldn't let me contact my lawyer. I thought in my mind, this is like New Orleans. Next, it's going to start all over again. But it didn't take place, and I stayed there for a month and a half. The climate in the country, to me, is much like it was back in the 70s, the late 60s, early 70s. It's designed to squash any form of dissent. If you're not going along with the program, then you're a problem. Some of us have taken a stand that we consider that whatever the consequence, we're not going to cave into this.
The organizing that took place as a member of the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense, that it was motivated by love of my people. It was motivated by a desire to serve a greater cause other than myself.
I still try to serve the community that's functioning, different functions in my community. And what happened with this experience of that, it just reminded me that it never goes away, that they maintain the same status quo, that power, people in power is going to run over and exploit whatever they want, and they're continuing to brutalize, kill, anywhere on the planet they choose to do that, and they feel justified because they have that power.
Currently, in the wake of 9/11, with the United States' implementation of the Patriot Act, many of the behaviors of the FBI that have been condemned by the Church Committee Report have been re-legitimized in the Patriot Act. So the same kind of illegal activities that were happening under COINTELPRO have resurfaced under the USA Patriot Act.
The grand juries are being used across the country to intimidate and to put pressure on witnesses to testify about things that they are of no consequence in many cases. People from animal rights to civil rights to human rights. Anyone, like it was in the 70s, who's an activist or speaks out against the war or even against the bird flu can be brought in front of a grand jury and intimidated.
30 years later, I found that nothing has actually changed. I'm being faced with charges from 30 years ago. And actually with the same people that were charging me and accusing me of this 30 years ago. And actually what I see is that Homeland Security is actually an extension of COINTELPRO, which according to the government was illegal and unconstitutional. And I wanted to go anywhere to tell people about this experience. And let them know that this still happens. It happens every day. And not only here, but same thing is happening in Guantanamo Bay. Same thing is happening in Iraq, Iran. All over the world, same thing is happening in Africa. Everywhere that he's been able to spread misery and exploit and try to take advantage of world resources, if you got something that the power structure wants, he does whatever he has to do to get it. I'm really sick of these same people with the same program, with the same attitude, with the same agenda. That's to destroy us, to destroy anybody that is strong-willed and is willing to stand up and fight for their community and their people.
I myself was harshly punished. I myself, present child in 2005, being harshly punished for being a member of the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense. But I accept the challenge. I accept this challenge so that my children's children's children will have some dignity. My nieces and nephews will have dignity and have purpose and understand the history of struggling in this country for basic human rights. And that's all we were trying to do. Basic human rights.
Investigate some of these they call it open cases. and it created these joint tasks with both federal authorities and state authorities, much like they did in the 70s to go after the Panthers. And so they sort of recreated these organizations, these task force, to go after these brothers and other former Panthers and members of the Black Liberation Army. And so they sort of reinvestigated these cases and bringing them, I guess, trying to recharge against folks. Post this documentary, which happened, they did convene, as folks heard, a grand jury. The grand jury has not indicted these state folks. This is under the state of California, their system. And so what happened was that because this grand jury was convened before any charges were brought, that is why they started bringing these folks in who they later wanted to charge as witnesses, gave them immunity, and told them that they had to testify, and that they didn't testify, then they would, once again, be put in jail as they told you until the grand jury time ran out. And then what happened was they would do that, refuse to testify, some of those folks were already put in jail, the grand jury went out, they let them back out, and then they would spend the grand jury time again. So currently, under the California system, what they did was that they charged them anyway, even though the grand jury did not, at this particular point, decide to indict any of these folks. So there were 9 folks who were charged. 8 of them have been, basically, some were already in prison. 5 were rearrested on these charges and brought to California. They were not already in California. 3 of them in particular, based out here in New York, 2 are already political prisoners in New York State Prison, who may know Kermit Bell and Jaleel Montague, who are former Black Panther Party members and members of the Black Liberation Army, who have been in prison in New York State for almost over 30 years already, and are now being charged again with these crimes 30 years ago. And particularly, we think some of the reasons why they're going after them, they are on parole now, both Jaleel and Kermit. Not so much we think based on the charge they were convicted of, that they may get parole, which you never know. So now, re-indicting and recharging them for a new crime, we're of course assured that they would never see the light of day. So I'm going to just start off there. Also, I think I wanted to mention to folks that, I guess 2 things. One is, in terms of spreading the word about who these folks are. This is a very easy thing for people to do if you're interested in these cases, interested in learning more, and we're interested in making sure that other people who are not already politically active know more about what's happening and know more about these cases. This video that we just saw is online. Encourage people online. There's a website that you can go to. It's on materials that I gave you. With included in that is some fact sheets that I probably passed out earlier that I didn't really ask about now. A good overview about what the case is about, so that folks can talk about what's been taking place. And lastly, before I get to open up for questions, for those of you who are politically active and people like the probably most of you in the room, it is extremely important for those of us who are politically active to remember folks who came before us. Folks who try to lay out their lives, like put their lives at stake. I've been in prison once again for over 30 years. These are the folks who came before us, who sort of set the ground and set everything in motion for us to be active today. And no liberation struggle, no movement worth anything in the world does anything without talking about freedom fighters, disabled prisoners, and the folks who came before us. In fact, you and I can obviously assume that everybody here reads a lot. If you read about, struggles around the world, you constantly hear about folks talking about getting out there from the prisons, talking about the people who once again sacrificed their lives in certain ways to be in prison, and talking about we won't do anything until we get those folks out of prison. For any negotiations around anything, around our rights, our land, our liberties, also has to include the struggle for these opportunities. So we think it's really important that we too, in a different context of the work that we do, that we start reintroducing that theme into our work. That there are people once again who came before us, who worked hard, who sacrificed a lot, probably more than any of us have ever sacrificed or could sacrifice. And these folks are locked down in prison and they need our support and our help. It may not be something that we can maybe master at this point, but at the very least, we can start by making it something that's important to activists, organizers, and folks who consider themselves revolutionaries. Get out there and include things about the Panther, things about the Black Liberation Army in your organizing work so that folks can be involved in knowing who these folks are, what they've done, and how they have to support. So at this point, I think we can do there's any questions about anything that wasn't covered in the video or anything anybody wants to meet to expand on or anything like that. Anything? This question was to compare COINTELPRO in the 1960s to some of the sort of squashing of like civil liberties and political rights that people have now. What people are trying to exercise that. And I think it's one of the assumptions that Sophia Elijah mentioned. There's the Patriot Act, which we all know about. And what the Patriot Act did was use terrorism as a way to squash political dissent once again. So the theme of the definition of terrorism is so extremely broad that almost any activity that's meant to, let's say, fight against the government, any activity that's meant to change something, can be thought of as being a terrorist activity. Mass demonstrations and working and civil disobedience and direct actions can, under the rubric of the Patriot Act, be thought of as a terrorist act. So far, it has not been used as such, but the language is broadened so that if there was, let's say, Seattle or something like that, there was a replay of something that happened where there was property damage, or something that happened where someone shot to a fire, a police officer. But that language in the Patriot Act is that broad where that person can be charged under the Patriot Act, and that person can be investigated under the Patriot Act, which means like wiretaps without any judge giving permission for it, which means infiltrating organizations, and some of which have already been experienced, right? People know about some of the things that happened with the Republican National Convention a few years ago, where a lot of organizations were infiltrated. So the similarities are great. You know, the our ability to fight it or some of the consequences, at least for some of us, have not been as severe as that yet. But the similarities are there, and the possibilities are there. So for us, it means that, once again, as organizers, that not that we stop our activity, of course, but just that we be more diligent in the type of organizing that we do, sort of security and all that kind of stuff. Because the biggest tool that they use, more than even using COINTELPRO tactics, is the scare tactic. Tactic that makes you so scared to do anything because you feel like somebody's watching you with your character and all that kind of stuff. So the point was, be security conscious, of course, so we are organizing that for them, but not be scared at all. If we get scared off of nothing, then they can automatically. Any other questions?
Yeah, this is grand juries were mentioned and are essential to this. Without, I guess, offering any sort of legal advice or anything like that, what are some of the options, I guess, that people who have had, who have been subpoenaed by grand juries, what are some of the options they've explored as far as approaching?
The biggest option is what folks do is to decide not to testify. And, you know, throughout the history of the use of grand juries, particularly for political charges, folks have done that. Either, you know, people who are in organizations with the person that might be charged, friends, allies, that kind of thing, they decide not to cooperate with the grand jury. What's going to, what they do in the grand jury is they say, you're going to have immunity. So whatever you say, this grand jury process won't be used against you unless you change your story later on. So by not giving you immunity, for you is supposed to mean that you no longer have any Fifth Amendment rights, right? So now you can testify and you can't be prosecuted for what you said. So that's their way of trying to force you to testify. Obviously, the point of that is they're not trying to gather evidence on you, they're trying to gather evidence on your movement or your comrades and so forth and so on. And so what people do is they become grand jury resistors. So they decide not to testify. Now, what's the, you know, the consequence of sacrifice? A lot of times it can be you being in jail for a certain amount of time. Usually it's no more than 18 months. In order until the grand jury comes out, it should be no more than 18 months. But that's the flip side of what they can. It doesn't always happen, but that's the thing over your head. That if you don't testify and you leave this community, we're going to lock you up. And so once again, that's why it's really important for us to talk about political work to understand that that tactic is used to scare you. That tactic is used to make you try to testify and say something. We always, in terms of we, folks who are quote-unquote movement lawyers or whatever, always tell folks that it's best never to testify in any manner. But you never know what you may say, even if you think you don't have any information to give, right? You never know what you may say that could be used against somebody else. And you don't know what you may say against people. Once again, you just against you, because it's an investigative issue, not informed. They're trying to get you, make you think that you give them the most, you know, simple of information. On that day, I was here. I wasn't over there, so I don't even know what you're talking about. But you may have established something that for somebody else. Oh, so you weren't there. So now we know that where you were, we know that so-and-so might have said that they were with you, and now maybe that's changed. Or so-and-so might have said that they wasn't with you, you've now changed, you've now given us more stuff to go on. And you tell them the location where you were back in that time period, so now we have a place to go investigate. So the simplest things that you think won't lead to anything can lead to something. So it's better to be a resistor and to not testify, because once again, you just don't know what kind of information you need to get.
I was wondering if you guys were investigating or trying to publicize the attacks on the Panther progeny, the sons and daughters of the Panthers, for example, Frederick Jr. said that that the same cop that attacked his father attacked him and helped arrest him on false drugs. And there's been attempts to murder him, and more controversial, Tupac Shakur, when he was 18 years old, was head of the city group of New African Panthers. And they tried to hide his politics and pretend to be a gangster rapper who were to politicize gangs. And it was, got seven attempts on his life, reeled into the hands of the police directly, before he was killed. And there's a lot of evidence that the whole East West War was a replication of the East West War created between the Black Panthers, created by the FBI. So that same thing was reintroduced for Tupac and New York, other rappers. But then it's used as an excuse to attack other rappers, particular political rappers. I'm wondering if you guys are investigating that more, publicizing that. You know, what's Martin saying? There's a hip hop, rap, hip hop cops, but they kind of undermine and say, oh, it's just surveillance, when actually there's evidence that it involved murderous attacks. So,
just to respond, we've done some work not only about this question, we could have published it in the groups, on publicizing and doing articles, including the ACLU, as his brother named King Downing, who's an attorney who's done a lot of work in particular on trying to expose the hip hop task force, which some folks do relay in terms of there's a lot of the tactics that are used and are similar to the public talk force. So, investigative tactics are not necessarily going to lead to arrest or not, but investigative tactics to see what are these folks involved in. Are these folks being politicized? Are they political? Are they trying to galvanize people to change behaviors and be organized with that? So that is stuff being used a lot. We try to do some work on it. In terms of the sort of Panther youth, one of the things that happened is not so much that we have been doing investigations and so forth, but for a lot of the Panther youth in particular, once, instead of say years after their parents were arrested and charged for a particular amount of time, these Panther youth were following around themselves. So we've had stories of folks who, one reason why they're not necessarily because they're going through that time period from the 70s and the 80s, where they were followed from going to school. And they were followed, like, playing with their friends, and they would stop and ask questions about stop a few times and ask, do you know where your mother is? So, we haven't done a lot of work in that general area, except for the President Anthony Pace. I think it's been a lot of work done on that in particular. But a lot of folks who are former family members and children not been too politically involved, and that's one of the reasons why. But there's still a lot of work to do on that.
What position do you think that the Black movement plays in the leftist, like the greater leftist aspect today? Like, I'm hearing a lot of criticisms even from a lot of leftist groups, like, for instance, Feminists Now claim that a lot of Black Panthers were like male chauvinists or communists, saying that the Black movement didn't really have, didn't really have the correct tools to move along, the new struggle. Or even the idea that some movements have trumped the Black movement, like in media coverage, like immigration or homosexual movement or whatever the case may be. What do you feel about those two things?
I guess in general, what I feel about the... One is I think all our movements are being undercut, let's say, in terms of either our sort of collective work we do together. Two is none of our movements are any as powerful as they were back in the 60s and 70s. A lot of that is due to culture outcrop, and a lot of that is, of course, due to the fact that back in the 60s and 70s, there was a lot more media attention that was focused in on the type of organizing and activism that was happening. And just remembering those times,
you know, folks back in the day called rallying at 10,000, 20,000 people that came out. So it was a particularly politically sort of active time where you had like African nations, Black American nations being freed and liberated and so forth. And you had people who felt like the liberation movement was happening tomorrow, or liberation was happening tomorrow, whatever that meant to different folks. Obviously, the Black liberation movement, or Black movement, still plays, I guess, a strong role and a leading role in terms of what I feel, in terms of what movement activity is happening today. Because I think one of the questions that's still unanswered, obviously, in America is the question of race. And one of the things that always comes up in America is the question of race. And so that is going to be something that we, as a movement, are going to have to sort of deal with and talk about. How do we intersect in terms of our movement? I think all movements have valid places and struggle, and all movements have to learn how to work together and participate with each other. And I think it's one trumping the other, but us figuring out how we're going to collaborate with each other's work, where it is that we're going to find new coalitions that we're going to join, and what are the things that we have in common, and those things that we don't have in common at one point in time, how do we just at least support folks and make sure that everybody's covered and safe? So, in particular, one thing that happens is if you have something like this, it's great that all folks come out and support folks like the Black Panthers. If we have other people who, other struggles that happen, you have those folks arrested, then it's our responsibility to come out and support those struggles and other folks. So I think it's a matter of us collaborating and kind of working together more than anything. But I don't see sort of a hierarchy of movements at this point in time that we need to sort of think about this one or that one. I think it's work for us to do and to support each other.
I don't know what
Speak a little bit.
Do you recommend any books?
There are Black Panthers Being Considered by Charles Jones, I believe. Shanti, you want to name one of those two? There's Revolutionary Suicide by Huey Newton. There's Seeds of Time by Bobby Seale. There's Asada by Asada. Is there been a book by Bob Vickian called
Depression of the Poor Churchill? Chapter 2 is fucking amazing.
Which talks a lot about COINTELPRO, what was happening in the movement at the time. Also, along those lines is the Boy at Home by Ryan Lick, which is a smaller book that talks a lot about COINTELPRO and its effect on the liberation movement in the 60s and 70s. So those are just the starters.
The one that Kathleen and George Hecker, somebody did. It's like Liberation, Imagination, something in the Black Panther Party, which is really good.
Y'all don't recommend a Lenny book?
I do actually recommend it. Elaine Brown has a book called A Taste of Power. So for you guys, if you can people here get that book and read it. Personally, I think it has a lot of good information in it. But that's what folks
think about. Kathleen Cleaver said she agreed that she makes a Elaine Brown's cover agent. And it didn't represent Huey Newton the way that Kathleen Cleaver moved you.
Well, folks, I don't want to get into debate about it, but folks have different opinions on who she is and what she represents in the movement. I think it's up to people to do their own investigations. The book is valuable, I think, because it has a lot of different information in it. And it's something that folks should pick up and read, and then encourage other literature out there, knowing what other people are saying about the book, and come to some of your own conclusions.
I have two questions. One is, in the Patriot Act, is the language not specific around the word coercion? The big definition of any attempt to change governmental policy through coercion can be addressed under the legislative rules of the Constitution. So really, it could be writing a letter to your congressman that's like, I won't vote.
What I was trying to say is that it's so broad, and even though it hasn't necessarily been applied in no specific instances yet, but that language is purposely so broad as to say maybe at some point, they feel the atmosphere is correct and the time is right, that they will apply to certain things. So you're right, so that administration can be coercion, right? Civil disobedience can be coercion. So if you think about activities that we engage in, once again, even though it has been used as such, simple acts can be thought of as coercion, and at some point, maybe they feel they are strong enough, they may try to say something on the board.
Yeah, that's a good question that I was going to say.
Yeah, I just was like, I'm wondering if it's accurate that most of the material that they use to open grand juries or to find suspects to interrogate and stuff like that, they get the starting thesis because they pull somebody into custody to ask them questions, and that person, without knowing that they can talk to an attorney person, can answer those questions. And that's really the point where all of these cases have always got to be going on. And right now, if you live in New York, you know, Kamau's organization and the National Lawyers Guild, they give very right strengths. And it's all like funny, cool ways to understand that you don't have to answer questions and how to deal with how to answer questions by
So despite the grand jury situation that's not participating, we do know your rights workshops, we do tell everybody, if you get arrested, the best thing to do is not to say anything so you can speak to a lawyer. You need a name, address, that kind of stuff, that's basic information. But anything about why I arrested you, but if you did with it, the best part is not to say anything. And the New York magic words are, I don't speak to an attorney. And that should have shut us down. If the FBI comes back against you, you can tell them, I don't want to speak to you. I want you to contact my attorney. Obviously, they have a warrant, and they're going to arrest you, they want to arrest you anyway. So, you're speaking to the law company at that particular point in time, but if you always speak to the attorney to find out what your rights are, what your case is all about, and they know, because you're probably the one who knows the least about the case at that point. And everybody else has information floating around, one of the things they do to try to make sure that you don't know what's happening, so that at least you can be just on the line, making questions with that sort of scenario, and then, you may once again say things that you shouldn't have said anyway, and maybe you want to relate to it like you're saying to somebody else. It's always best to make it stop getting arrested. I'm sorry, go ahead.
One of the reasons why Fred Hampton was targeted was whether the CCS had a criminal conspiracy section to see the CPD Chicago place. What is his effectiveness as an organizer, his effectiveness as a community negotiator, etc. High school leader. Okay, so that, together with the factors like, which other people here probably know more than I do, but Melvin Smith, Green Bonito, Packard Brown, the infiltration of this kind of thing was going on with PPP and the BLA, I guess, I don't know. But as the effectiveness, whether it's the North American liberation of Black Panthers, any movement these days, in proportion to the effectiveness of the movement, it's going to be targeted. So my question is, is there any kind of like strategy or, I don't know, non-intelligence, some kind of strategy for the evidence, the signals of infiltration, because of the way I'd like to live, dismantling and destruction of the party and other movements as well. I'm just wondering, is there an effort on part of somebody to come up with a, you know what I mean?
There's several groups, including what's been in our group of popular practices, and National Lawyers Group, I think, also, which will do training on security measures and organizations so that people can be aware of things to look out for in terms of government infiltration, in terms of office security, that kind of thing. Once again, one of the things that we recommend at Post Read is the book at home. I recommend that book probably more than anything because it's relatively small. The book at home by Brian Flick is a relatively small book, but it has a lot of information in it about home and health pro and about how it was used and measures that people can do to stop and or to try to see when these things are being used against organizations and actors. In addition to that, one thing that we also should point out is the Black Panther Party has a legacy in particular in the Black community and, of course, in the wider activist community. And so we think one of the reasons why the government still comes after the Panthers is because that legacy is still there, is because folks are still interested in learning more about who the Panthers were, what they did, what made them successful, what mistakes they made, how do you correct those mistakes. They're like a point in history which folks look at, particularly now, around which way to win and struggle. So we think that the government does a lot, or tries to do a lot, continually disparage that history to make folks look at criminals and involved in criminal activities and enable them as honest work. Once again, that saying is not to say that we can't do it, we're not making grave mistakes in terms of organizing, in terms of letting Ashanti also get involved in the Panthers. In terms of sexism and patriarchy, we did inform each other itself. There's a lot of mistakes that the Panthers made. But the Panthers have a heart, they have dedication, and they have politics that were important to our community, important to the broader struggle. And so that's why we think one reason in particular why these folks are still being targeted and why the legacy of the Panthers and the general black liberation struggle is being targeted. So it's important to keep that in mind. Take one or two more questions as I try to tie our ears. You said are there any solidarity with the there's already special events in New York around the San Francisco week. There's some that I gave out. Not only the first stuff, but the fact sheet has talking points about the case in particular. And once again, for folks who did come in, the video that we showed can be downloaded and purchased. And this particular fact sheet can be taken offline. And once again, this is a real easy thing for folks to talk about and to do things, you know, small events in your house. Things involved in your organization, other community events, just to inform people about what's happening. You can also, the website is listed here, you can give donations. You know, activists and organizers, in particular in San Francisco, California area, please let them know too if they don't know. We think it's really important for the California community to become extremely involved and politicized around that space, because that's what the jury group is with. So a lot of the work has to be done in that area. It's support work that we can do compared with a lot of that work that's going to be done in San Francisco and California in terms of really supporting these folks. Do you have any other bit of grab anyone from the top of the set?
Yeah, I would like to ask one question about the case of Mouman Abdul-Jabbar. So how do you connect the case with Philadelphia with this case?
All these cases are connected because they're all about.
One of the eight, he just been shipped from New York to California.
He's out there now in San Francisco, but they didn't give him his property yet. And he don't have no money and stuff like that. So I don't know if people are coming tomorrow, but I was going to try to put something out if people want to put a little collection together, then we would make sure that we get the money or to him. So it's just that. And then the other thing was like, for people not to get caught up into like what you read, whose opinion is about the book, is this or that, keep in mind that, you know, this whole thing is about getting these folks out. You know, so we don't want to get off into an intellectual thing about, well, this is Elaine Brown book and I don't agree with this and that. Stay focused, because what they're doing with the ape is like an attack on the black community. It's like part of this whole genocidal thing. You know, and people need to come behind it.
Yeah.
Let's just have a few things. You want to first of all, for not pretending to speak for an author, but the Black Panther Party and the Black Panther Party. Because I know the Shibi Peanuts Foundation had a statement that said that this is themselves from the new Black Panther Party. I just want to know in general what it is to support that.
Interesting question. Not sure if I can speak in general for like that party, because I think there's different opinions depending on who you ask. I think some people appreciate the fact that there are younger folks trying to carry on the legacy of the Black Panther Party, and they continue to do work with the new Black Panther Party. I think there are others who feel that the politics of the new Black Panther Party don't represent the politics that the Black Panther Party started off with. And so for them, because the politics are not what they think it should be, that they would rather not organize it. That's a simple answer, but I think it splits in that way. There's some folks who rather try to work with them and feel like they can bring them up to speed per se, or work with them and bring them to some more collective politics around the campus had, some of the best practices of campus, let's say. But there are others who feel like, oh, this is not quite representative, so they're more focused. But I want to thank everybody for coming once again. Please go to the website and check out the website. All the materials that we gave you, and if you have any individual questions, ask them.